Episode 48, Season 16 of Geek Speak. This week's Geek Speak episode is a little different. It's just me, Lyle, and I wasn't able to get people together for the Thanksgiving break. I was on vacation with my family. But I did have a really wonderful conversation with Quincy Larson a week or so ago, and I thought I'd continue chatting with him. Quincy, of course, was on Geek Speak before in June 29th about Free Code Camp. He's the founder of Free Code Camp, and I recommend listening to that episode. He now has an article called How to Encrypt Your Entire Life in Less Than an Hour. I've been reading a lot of the Medium for Free Code Camp, where Quincy has collected a lot of wonderful writers, and every week they're producing really wonderful blog entries. And I want to talk to Quincy about blogging on the Medium platform with Free Code Camp, and also to chat with him about how to encrypt your entire life in less than an hour. It's just a good example of some of the writing he's been doing, and I thought the topic was interesting as well. This week, though, prior to doing that, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Automator. I'm a programmer, of course, and I do a lot of development on OS X platform. And I love OS X because of a rich feature set of Unix backbone underneath the operating system. And I use quite a bit of those features in developing software. Normally, the build process we have in any kind of development requires quite a few steps. And doing that in a Unix backbone environment is pretty cool. The side effect of having anything that you can compile on a Linux environment or Unix environment, you can also have work on an OS X environment, means that you kind of made the backbone of the operating system much richer. It's a richer ecosystem of development. And so in doing node development, the compilation step of doing things on OS X is relatively simple, for example. And all the normal build steps of C compilers and make build processes is all there. Additionally, Apple over the years has done development in a system, an application called Automator, and a whole bunch of development in AppleScript. And both of these endeavors have been to allow the general free structure of doing tasks on a computer in a way that is not manually intensive, automating the process. The Automator application, I'm not sure actually when it came about, but you can open up Automator and using visual drag and drop kind of programming techniques, you can make a automation task, a set of tasks that you do that is could potentially be redundant. You can make it really easy. And this is basically programming. It's a very low-level programming. But in the form they take, and also the AppleScript language, the form they take is, hey, you want to tell your computer how to do something. Here's how you do that. And that is what programming is, right? Programming is the very structured communication of tasks to do on a computer, right, for a computer to follow. This last month, actually in October, Saul Sogan was fired, laid off, quit, fired, no, fired, from Apple. Apple just decided that they didn't need his skills anymore. And what Sal's been doing, he has been the automation advocate for Apple. He's been employed in Apple since 1997. And through the years, he has made sure that Apple has been a healthy place, or OS X has been a healthy place for automation processes, meaning that he's making sure that the Unix CLI is rich and full, command line interface. That's the backbone I was talking about. This includes things like applications like grep and find and cat and all the wonderful features of the Unix operating system that allows you to actually program very lightly small things, make your computer do what you want to do in a light way. He's been responsible for making sure that that's there. He's been making sure that the shell environment has been rich. He's helped to make sure that Python and Ruby and Perl have been part of OS X. These are more robust scripting languages. And he's also been making sure that Apple events and AppleScript and JavaScript are all capable on the platform. And this is essential. An Apple event might be when something is dropped into a folder, a Finder folder, an Apple event fires. And that allows you to set up a automation task that watches a folder for changes to the folder structure. And here's a great example, and probably one of the quintessential examples of using Automator. Let's say that you take photographs on multiple cameras, and when you bring them to your computer, what you want to do is you want to name them consistently. The example I take is that I name every single photo that I take with the date that it was taken. And the format is a four-digit year, dash, a two-digit month, dash, a two-digit day. So for example, November 25th would be 2016-11-25 underscore. And then from there on out, I use whatever the camera I was using's nomenclature. So my cameras produce a four-digit number that kind of loops every 10,000. It starts over again. Great. So I just use that number. And then, of course, .jpeg or .raw, whatever the file format is. So the idea is that every single time a photo hits my system, it becomes date-based. And the reason for that really is that I know that helps me identify unique things. It is an interesting part of a photo. If you've ever looked through old photos in a shoebox, you know that knowing the date is a big part of the process. Knowing who's in it, too, is important, but you don't always know who's in it. In fact, some photos don't have people, right? So the idea of having any other kind of naming convention, I couldn't think of anything that's more specific. And additionally, though the metadata exists in the file, that means in the EXIF data that the camera produces, there is information. Sometimes that information does not migrate across different web services and different other services. So having the file name be unique and have it be the date means that you won't lose that file as you use it in different ways. When I resize them, I always keep the file name on there as well. Okay. So that's the file name. The additional process you need is a file structure, directory structure. So you also might, in your automation process, say, oh, I also want to put these photos in a year and a month and a date folder structure. And that's what I do. I have a 2016 and then a November and, of course, October and so on. And those are all just two-digit numbers and then also the date and then the file goes in there. And this structure allows you to do really clean backups, right? You know you can take all of your October photos and move them onto a disk. And additionally, over time, you stop writing to the older systems, which allow backup software to know that, oh, nothing's changed in 2015 for a year, so I don't have to do anything in that folder for backups. So that's the structure that I like. And not all software does that, uses that structure. In fact, no one does it out of the box necessarily that way. But I started a long time doing that, and I want to continue doing that. So Automator comes in. I grab an Automator script, and I say, okay, start with an Apple event when files change in this folder structure. Anytime a new photo goes in there, grab the photo, look at the EXIF data of the photo, and that look at the EXIF data is actually an Apple script or an Automator task, which is actually using probably Apple script under the hood to use a library for EXIF data reading. And this is all built in Automator. And then I would then say if this folder doesn't exist, the year folder, create it. If this month doesn't exist, create it. If this day doesn't exist, create it. Now take the file and save it to that location using the last half or the number, the incrementing number and the current date structure in the form I want to save to this file. And then erase the folder, or you could actually move it as well from the original location. So now, every time I take any of my devices, I plug them in my machine, I grab all those files, I drop them into a folder, and I walk away. And the automated process kicks in and it renames all these files and moves them to the right location. Now, Saul has been responsible for making sure all of that works. He's been the developer advocate, if you will, for automation and all these other services. And he was let go in October, and he was told that the position he has will no longer exist at Apple. And this is frustrating. Frustrating because, of course, we don't know what Apple's intent is at this point. But I want to talk about this in a broader sense. What is Automator actually doing? What the translation of that is a more rich set of steps that my computer can do for me that I set up, right? It is a form of programming, but it's set up in such a way as to be instructions, right? It's not, you're not wanting to have someone that use Automator necessarily have a computer science degree, become an expert in programming. The Automator was designed to help people make their machines do things for them. So let's talk about other things that Apple's been investing in the years. Siri is the exact same thing. It's a process like Automator that tries to do what the user wants in a very fluid way with natural language, right? It is the end-all be-all of AppleScript, if you will, except that it's not fully rich because in a scripting language, you can write things down and read it and try it and run it and have visual context of what you're talking about at every time. You know, in AppleScript, it's things like tell Finder, which is like a global object, which is the operating system in some ways, but really the Finder application on the operating system. Tell Finder to open folder, and then you have to give it a name. And then tell application mail to create a new message, right? All these things are steps. And in a scripting language, you can see those steps and kind of confirm that they work at some level because auto syntaxing, highlighting and stuff shows you that it's the task you're looking for works. And you can try running it a few times. But in a language process environment, the context of the conversation is more nuanced. And the ideas of understanding are more nuanced. This is why artificial intelligence is so tricky. You have to assume that you have a understanding in the communication that is real. And in reality, of course, AppleScript's not like that. Siri is not like that. What's really going on with Siri is Siri has a whole bunch of pre-programmed tasks. And all the system is trying to do is find out which one of those you're actually asking for. And that's why there's so many errors, right? Siri has no context of how you think. It really has an idea that, oh, I know how to open a folder on my computer, or I know how to read a text message. So if the person's asked something and it fits the pattern that matches best the read a message, I will do that task. Now, it could be that the team that Siri is moving forward is pushing forward in the idea of replacing all the things that an automator type scripting environment can do. That would be amazing. At some point, yes, we'll have that. Right now, we don't, and I think we're a long ways from that. At the same time, new modules of understanding are coming online quickly, and stitching those together, which is like what Automator has been doing for years, definitely the focus you want to put in is in the natural language processing and AI space, because if you succeed there, you win in every way. The computer all of a sudden always does what you want, which is the goal in the first place. Okay, another tack that Apple could be doing is that Apple's been doing a lot of work in Swift. In Swift is the programming scripting language that Apple's replacing their Objective-C programming language with. I actually develop Objective-C all the time in the iOS app I work on, and Swift is the newer paradigm. It's been out for 3 years or so. Apple has open sourced it, which means a lot. It's a growing resource language. This is similar to Ruby and Perl that I just mentioned earlier. But the language is a contemporary language. People agree that it's a really wonderful language, very expressive, and does some great things. And one of the things Apple's been showing off Swift with is a thing called Swift Playgrounds. And you can actually run Swift code on a fully running operating system on iOS. So in iOS 10, you can download the application called Swift Playgrounds on your tablet. And on your tablet, you can actually start writing Swift language. And that will get interpreted real time and not without a compile step and actually run. And that process is scripting language, right? Meaning that you can write something, you can test it and run it, and then you can see what it does. And it's called Playgrounds because it's a way of learning the Swift language and also learning all the kits that exist inside iOS for development. It's a great way to learn programming. It's probably the biggest way it will be influential is letting people have a really simple way of starting to learn to program. It also is cool when you're like just have a tablet with you and you want to play around with some of the features that Swift and iOS have to offer. So they're doing a lot of development in that scripting language environment. And that could be that they're going to say, you know what, we're going to do all new automation using the Swift language. And in some ways, it does make sense to do that because they have a real-time interpreter. They can run that on even iOS. Something Automator doesn't exist on iOS. And Swift, of course, can also be run on macOS, and macOS already has Swift as a language, as I mentioned earlier, like Perl and Ruby. It's embedded in the operating system all the time now, which means that you can run small scripts in Swift on the device just like those other things. So you could, I can imagine that as you extend the communication between applications, you would do that with Swift libraries totally makes a lot of sense. So it's possible they're just letting go of Saul because that whole group that does automation under him is actually going to be switched under to the same people that are doing Swift stuff. So it could be Swift, it could be Siri, it could be a combination of both. And letting go of Saul does not necessarily mean that Apple is dropping all automation completely from their system. I hope they're not. One last thing about Automator. Though I'm a programmer and though I've used Automator in the past to do the task I was talking about with moving files around and folder structures for photos, in reality, I use Adobe Lightroom, which is a paid application I pay regularly, I think a monthly fee, to Adobe to manage my library of photos. I'm a photographer. I've got 200,000 photos or so or more, and they're all organized in that date format that I was talking about. And Adobe has made a naming convention for importing of photos in any way you want. They have a small automation step, if you will, that allows you to structure your file naming convention. For example, my file naming convention, I like to have the dashes between the year and the month and the day, but not everybody likes that. And it's easy in Lightroom to make a script that imports files that has a different naming convention, any convention you want, or leave the default, which I think does have dates involved, but I'm not sure. So that is interesting that for years now, I've been using Lightroom to do that small script of naming stuff, and I do not use Automator at all. Because Adobe software, they thought through what kind of features I want. And of course, Lightroom has a whole bunch of other features that I use, resizing photos and working with the raw file and never actually modifying the original file and tagging things. I tag people's names, so I can look up at people by name, for example. I think it's just interesting that the one quintessential example of Automator I haven't been using for years because some software developer produced exactly what I wanted, and I pay for that. And of course, in the end, Lightroom does do the tasks I want it to do. It does achieve the requests of, do this for me, computer, right? And it was developed by another party. So that's another strategy Apple might be doing is, hey, when you want your computer to do something, go get a piece of software that really smart people made that will do exactly that. And in some ways, I mean, that's what applications have been for years. So the glue of having Automator do certain small tasks or a simple way of making scripts that do these small tasks, it's because you don't have that task being done by a team of people that have produced a piece of software. And it is true that over time, as you have more and more developers writing software, you will run into situations where the thing you want has already been created. And so now it's just about finding those things, trusting those things, and potentially buying them to get your computer to do exactly what you want. On iOS, that's pretty much the process you do, because of course on iOS, there isn't an automation framework, if you will. I would hate to go through this whole talk about automation and getting your computer to do what you want on iOS without talking about a wonderful application that I've actually mentioned before on the show called Workflow. And Workflow is that automator for iOS. It's written by another application group. It's not written by Apple, but it does allow you to take a photo and blend and take four photos and send it to Workflow and create a workflow, a little script that allows you to make an animated GIF from those four photos. And on iOS, I have used Workflow a lot. I use Workflow to read web pages. I use Workflow to create animated GIFs because it's like a small creation of, it's automation steps. And it's fun to make. It's drag and drop, just like Automator. And I have to say that it is possible, of course, the other tack that Apple is doing is that somebody will make a Workflow type application for the Macintosh operating system. So we won't see necessarily the death of automation. And if you're really curious about automation, do try Workflow on iOS. I think it's a paid application, but it is a lot of fun to play with. All of that said, I understand Apple dropping Workflow. Dropping Automator. Because if you look at the most people that use their computers, they don't use it. They don't use that app. And for most people to not use an app that Apple creates is kind of a waste of resources for Apple, right? It makes more sense for Apple to focus on the applications people use and let go of the ones that aren't as common and useful for everybody. So that's probably the biggest reason they're dropping Automator, the application. And of course, they'll keep it around. They're not going to terminate it because why get rid of it? It'll slowly get less and less useful It'll slowly degrade, most likely. And hopefully Siri and Swift and some other external application will fill the void for those users that need specific automation tasks on OS X. I want to take this moment to thank our sponsors, our patrons that donate money every month to make GeekSpeak a success. So thank you everyone that participates by supporting GeekSpeak. And thanks for the pleasant reviews you make and the word of mouth and the emails you send in asking questions and making comments. I love it. Keep it coming. Our email address is geeks@geekspeak.org. And of course, you can find out how to support our program by going to geekspeak.org/support. Regular listeners to GeekSpeak will recall that in, June 29th of 2016, I invited Quincy Larson to be on GeekSpeak. We talked about Free Code Camp. And if you don't recall that episode, I do urge you to listen to our archive. It was a wonderful show about his motivations and what he does in life right now. And since that day, Quincy invited me to start reading his blog, which he posts up on Medium. And I have to say that it's been a pleasure to regularly read all the wonderful content you have. Quincy, thank you for joining me again on GeekSpeak.
Thank you very much for having me, Lyle.
So a couple things I just noticed I want to talk about. I mean, Medium, of course, has become this great blogging location and space. It's really wonderful in the sense that you comments and stuff seem to be go pretty smoothly, and highlighting and commenting on chunks of the text is pretty supported. So it seems to be a pretty good platform to communicate long form blog entry time forms. Can you give me some feeling about what you like about it, what you don't like about it in general?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the real reason we moved to Medium has very good infrastructure, and their team's pretty responsive, and they've implemented a lot of features we've requested, such as better code, like embedding code. Hopefully eventually they'll have some form of like syntax highlighting and stuff like that. Right now, when you input code, it's just basically monospace font, but mm-hmm. It's better than not supporting code at all. The main reason we use Medium is there's just a huge audience there, especially of developers and designers and people who are generally interested in technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does seem to fit really well the audience that you regularly address, which people are wanting to learn to code, and teachers as well. The other thing I've noticed is most of the articles you write, you get really wonderful imagery to start the post with. We're going to talk a little bit today about how to encrypt your entire life in less than an hour, which is just a general like best practice, pretty much following what I do in my life about what I encrypt and what I don't encrypt and how I think about things. So it's just nice to have an opportunity to chat with you again and kind of go through those steps. But in this, you've got this wonderful image by Frederick Uribe from 2012.
Yeah, Federico Uribe. He's an artist from, honestly, I can't remember which specific country. He has made some amazing art that I would strongly recommend people look at. And it's very, he uses a lot of symbolism, and like he started out painting and then he moved to mixed media and using like essentially found, objects to create art. So he has this one, piece. I think he's made more than one of these. It's basically a lion's head, and it's made entirely of high caliber rifle bullets.
Ooh, pretty. So a whole bunch of brass.
Yeah. It's just very visually capturing
and disturbing.
Yeah. I mean, you can read all kinds of symbolism in that and poaching and things like that.
And the piece you used for your article here is Connected with the Past, which is looks like audio cables. Different audio cables are probably less than contemporary in some ways. And it's also a man's kind of screaming, and it's a cool image. It seems to fit your piece pretty well. Do you normally get rights and stuff? Do you connect with the artist and ask, or do you just attribute?
I just attribute. I'm always very careful to attribute any art that I use. Sometimes there will be pop cultural images that are just so ubiquitous, like an image of Batman from a movie or something. Technically, like I guess I could write the studio and ask for permission to include that in my blog. I've never had any of them reach out to me and ask me to take anything down.
I think there's a time when it's kind of the cult. It's so embedded in the culture that it's hard to separate our culture from it. It becomes something that should be usable, of course, unless Disney owns it, in which case you're going to have trouble.
Yes. Yeah. So what I generally use, like if I find some art, then I'll just use the art. Like I wrote a story a while back that had featured a lot of Salvador Dali's paintings, and I think technically those are still copyrighted, like they're still covered under copyright, and I would, you know, potentially need to get permission to use them. But I mean, it's just so important culturally that I don't think anybody thinks twice about including. I don't think his estate is going to track me down and ask for me to pay them a licensing fee to feature his art, for example.
Yeah. So I've had a history of kind of sharing with people how to be more careful online, and just in general the idea of you know, using VPN when you're at a shared space, or at least using HTTPS when you're in a public Wi-Fi environment. Over the years, what I've learned is the trickiest part about using the tools of security and being private online and making sure your data is encrypted and everything is the complexity does not scale at a level that everyday people can accept. So the trouble is not being secure. The trouble is making it relatively easy to be secure.
Right. There's a whole lot of low-hanging fruit where you can get like secure enough. I mean, of course, that's going to depend on your specific use case. If you're in a country where you're, you know, you would be persecuted for having the viewpoints you have, or the people whom you're talking with are, you know, political criminals or something like that, then your standards of security may be higher than if you merely don't want a huge amount of content that's accessible that could be used to incriminate you for some charge. So there's a quote in the article that is from Cardinal Richelieu. I think it's a French name. I'm probably completely butchering it. But basically he said, "If one would give me six lines written by the hand of the most honest man, I could find something in them to have him hanged." And I think just by virtue of having a sheer volume of content out there that investigators could potentially draw upon to build a case against you, even a person who is, you know, free from having done anything illegal, you know, could potentially have a case built against them. It's not extremely likely to happen, but it's fairly easy to prevent. So I wrote this article basically trying to address a lot of like the low-hanging fruit things you can do to make your life relatively secure and make your communication relatively private and your files private so that you just don't really have to worry about that as much.
Right.
And of course, I'm quick to point out in the article, no system is secure. No system is 100% secure or 100% private by virtue of the complexity that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Just there's so many possible exploits. There's so many unknown unknowns. Anybody who says that their cryptography is uncrackable or that they're a method of transmitting information, there's no way that somebody could break in and siphon data out of it. Like, be extremely skeptical of those claims.
Right. You have to think about it, I guess, kind of like the mantra of sex in the 90s. It's safer sex, or it's safer security. It's not perfectly safe, not perfectly secure. I agree. I think the way you started out, by the way, talking about tip one, number one, the use of two-factor authentication for your inbox is so paramount, because our inbox becomes the basic authentication system for so many different services. I mean, if you forget your password on almost every service, you can get a reset link sent to your email. So your email becomes this hub. And if you don't have control over it and you don't make sure that you're the only one that can access to it, people can get into other services really easy through your inbox. So I agree that that's a really important one. Do you want to describe, I mean, first off, two factors used some places. Like, you can get two-factor authentication on Google for, you know, on Gmail, for example. But if you're doing your own email server, is this even really an option for an individual?
I think that there are some libraries that you could potentially, you know, incorporate, yeah. Or you could just, you know, write your own. I'm not sure how complicated it is to write your own two-factor authentication. There are lots of tools that are open source that like I would certainly look at before trying to write your own. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if like enterprise email services, like if you had like Microsoft, I don't even know what the enterprise email services are. The one we use is Gmail, of course, and Gmail offers two-factor authentication. By using this, you should significantly reduce the likelihood of somebody being able to break into your account. Because now not only do they need to figure out your password, but they also need to get a hold of your phone or figure out some way to like spoof your phone number. I can't remember if it's technically the word is spoof, but basically like they need to be able to simulate having your phone number so they can receive the text message and get the code out of it.
Yeah. So the two-factor authentication methods that can be used, and by the way, for corporate email at Netflix, we also use Gmail. So it is kind of becoming a pretty popular thing. Also, my kids in public schools here in California use Gmail. So there is a bit of a level of use in that situation. And I just want to kind of also refer to people, if they're running their own servers, you have to be really on top of it. If you're using your local ISP or any ISP, the email they gave you, I recommend moving away from that email because that email is locked to the service you're paying for that to them. So if you like use Comcast and you have a Comcast email, you really should move away from that because at some point you might want to change your ISP and then you're kind of stuck with your email. So slowly migrate people away. You can keep both there. Go ahead and make a Gmail account or something of that nature and move your friends and communication through that. And then eventually the old email won't be important enough anymore. So the two ways of doing this two-factor authentication is one through the text message, which is relatively ubiquitous in the sense that everybody's got a phone that can receive a text message. But there is a little bit more spoofability in that regard. I use an authentication app. Do you use that yourself for your two-factor?
Yes. I tried to set it up in preparing this article. Mm-hmm. I was using the text message, and a lot of people pointed out there is some vulnerability there. Although I'll point out, it's absolutely safer to use two-factor authentication with text messages than to not use two-factor authentication
right.
at all.
Right.
But if you want additional security and additional convenience, then using the app would be good. Unfortunately, when I tried to get it set up on my computer, it was a complicated process, and it didn't end up working for some reason. Google server was down or something.
Yeah, I recently had trouble turning on two-factor authentication or getting my two-factor authentication keys moved to a new device. I got a new phone for work, mm-hmm. and it was very hard to get my GitHub one to work that way. But I finally got it working. Your article kind of synced up with me doing that recently and realized, yeah, I should be talking about this a bit more with people. But in general, the idea of these two-factor apps is that you download an app on your phone. Google Authenticator is the one I'm using on my iOS device, and it's available for Android as well. And you can add multiple tokens. And when you actually sign up for or you turn on two-factor authentication, you get given a QR code. You scan that QR code with the app. It gets added as a key. The first thing you did, that the number that it gives you, a six-digit number, every minute cycles a new one or every 30 seconds, whatever. Anytime you have to log in a new time or kind of confirm your identity, you use that new code that changes regularly and you just type it into the form. It normally queries you and presto bango, you get authenticated with the two-factor. And the other option, of course, is the text one, which I agree, it's better than not having two-factor authentication, even if there is a bit of a security concern, because someone has to be really highly targeting you to take advantage of the text message hole, if that makes sense.
And my understanding is they would still need your password.
Yeah, they need your password, and then they need to be tapping into your phone during that time when the message gets sent. So, you know, there's a big difference between targeted attacks and non-targeted attacks. If you just have your account out there that doesn't have two-factor, someone could slowly just guess your password, or you could type your password at a hotel computer, and that computer might have a virus on it, and all of a sudden your password's available, and they can log in with it. And the worst case scenario with the two-factor authentication at that hotel is that when you leave, if you log out, and even if they've save the session, everything, you've terminated the session, even if they have your password saved, they can't actually log into your account because they don't have your phone with you as well. So it's definitely better than not having two-factor authentication.
The goal of this article is to just give people quick, low-hanging fruit.
Like yeah.
The goal being within 1 hour, you can do all these things. So actually installing the Google app and all those things, those are definitely recommended actions, but they may take a little bit longer. And for me, at the time when I attempted to do them, I couldn't even get it to work. So I didn't want to recommend that. I didn't want a bunch of people frustratedly sitting around trying to get it to work, even though everybody was shouting in the comments that the app is better.
Yeah, yeah. I use the app too. I like the app. I've never installed the app on my computer, though. I've only done it on my phone. And the other thing about these QR codes, you can actually, if you get that QR code, you can actually scan two devices at once. If you don't erase the QR code, you can have multiple devices set up. So if you have, like, you know, your partner's device at the same time when you set it up, you can actually scan the QR code on both devices. And then the code will be the same on both, and you can use either, which is convenient for a backup. But the other backup that's crucial when you do this is you've got to have recovery codes at this point. They're going to give you a list of codes, which are one-time use codes. And this is what you'll need if, like, your phone gets destroyed. Maybe you lose your phone number because you stop paying your bill on your mobile, and you can't receive a text message. Having those extra codes is really important. And people always recommend printing them. And I actually put mine inside my password archive. I use 1Password, which we're going to get to in a second, I think. In any case,
cool.
Keep your QR codes. I mean, keep your backup codes. Really important step. So you suggest encrypting your hard drive and as a step two, because if you don't encrypt your hard drive and your laptop's lost, all that data is there on your machine. All those passwords you've had emailed to your recovery things, all the stuff in your inbox is actually cached on your disk. And so that's really a big problem. I used to do a lot of support for people at the university, and one of the things that we always wanted to be able to do is recover people's data when a problem emerged. And when you've got encryption on your hard drive, the complexity of recovering the data just balloons. So why do you suggest encrypting hard drive? I mean, what do you think is a good – why do you think you should do it?
I mean, I certainly have – any proprietary data – any like sessions that haven't, signed out or anything like that. If people can get into my computer, or if they can figure out a way to extract it and bypass like the keyboard, like the password to log in, which, there's so much on that hard drive that people could potentially use to access your other accounts.
Yeah.
And of course all your personal files. So there's like a trade-off. As always, there's a tension between convenience and privacy.
Yeah.
And I think that this is one that I would recommend. I know it's possible people could lose their code or something like that.
I've been relatively careful in what I put on my computer of course, my finances are connected and stuff, and so losing property could be concerning. But I've never really had like highly personal things on my machines. Just because I understand the complexity of making that stay secret and private. But recently I started journaling about a month and a half ago, and I started writing a journal that, I really wouldn't want these thoughts to be representing me in any way, especially, 30 years from now. Who knows how I'll change everything. But these are important thoughts for me, and moving from paper to computer was nice because I can search it and all the benefits of computer. I type a lot faster than I write. So now all of a sudden I'm much more thoughtful about who has access, and encrypting a hard drive definitely makes sense in that regard. And I just have to say that when you choose to encrypt your hard drive, along with that, you really make sure that you've got a backup solution that's going to be good through a complete hardware catastrophe, like a drive crashing, because that will happen eventually. Even these SSDs do fail, and you don't want to lose your data. And on top of that, you don't want to have like the backup possibility be removed because of your encryption on the hard drive. But in any case, let's go ahead and go on to making sure your phone has some password protection. I use Thumbprint. Do you use Thumbprint on your phone?
I do. I use Thumbprint, and of course, if the Thumbprint fails, then after a certain number of failures, it'll fall back to a PIN, like a 4-digit code entry.
Mm-hmm.
Some people use 6 digits, but
I use actually full text. I have a longer text thing I've got to type every time. And it works pretty well because it's only during a reboot or if I've failed my thumbprints quite a few times, and my fingerprints don't seem to fail very much. So I probably have to enter that code, that manual code, maybe a couple times, maybe 3 times a week, which is a little annoying. And I'm not really even sure why I moved away from my PIN code. I think it had to do with my kids always seeing me. And if I have a keypad and they see me, they easily can guess they can see my PIN after a few attempts. They're quick eyes.
Right. And I've heard about people basically being able to take video playback of the way like a phone moves, mm-hmm. when people are inputting things, and from that actually extrapolate like which keys they're pressing.
Yeah.
So
this all comes down to how paranoid you want to be, right?
At the same time, your thumbprint can be lifted and
yes.
Be used to break into your phone. I think some security researcher did that recently.
Yeah, you can do a print of it, even from photographs. So none of these practices are perfectly safe. I don't feel like moving away from a four-digit PIN makes a lot of sense because the phone will lock you out after 10 tries or so. So as long as the code is relatively, randomy, and also you don't share it regularly. Now, when you enter in the code, you try to be conscious of your environment. I think it's relatively safe to have a four-digit PIN. If you want to be really protective, have a much longer one. Can you tell me about password services and why they're useful?
Sure. So I'm like a huge, detractor of passwords in general. I realize that at some point you need some password. Basically, the main problem with passwords is people don't use sufficiently secure passwords, which just means basically like a long password. It doesn't necessarily have to have a lot of symbols, although that does increase the entropy a little bit. So the main problem is people use the same password for multiple services. Then when one of those gets hacked, like LinkedIn did for Mark Zuckerberg, people can take Mark Zuckerberg's email address and his password that he used and go and try it on all these other services. And doing so, people were able to break into his Twitter account and his Pinterest account using the exact same password.
Yeah.
So that's very common. Sites are, there are huge database breaches every month. And those passwords can basically just be programmatically tried on all these different services, and attackers can gain access to your accounts. So if you make sure that your password is unique across all of those, you'll at least probably foil the automated attempts.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you make sure your password is not only unique but secure, then it's very difficult for someone who gains access to that password to use it elsewhere.
I have something like 50 different accounts, I'm sure, probably more online. Some of them I don't really care about. Most of them I do. Knowing 50 secure passwords seems like an arduous task for a human mind.
Yeah, I would certainly argue so. If you can use like a system, which a lot of people use, where they'll use like some combination of the website, like they'll use the word Amazon somewhere in the password, and then they'll just change that out. But of course, if a human is looking at that password, they may be able to figure it out, or they might even be able to write a script that looks for, like in LinkedIn, if somebody used the word LinkedIn in their password, it might figure out what tokens in that password are not the word LinkedIn, and then just change that out for Amazon when they attack the Amazon account.
And those kind of patterns. And those kind of patterns in cracking software are exactly what people write, right? They go, let's try to figure out anything in these passwords that are associated with the domain that's been like LinkedIn. Maybe it's just some of the letters, or maybe the letters all hashed into, or human hashable into something like numbers representing the letters like on a key phone. And the truth is, no matter how smart you think you're going to do on a pattern, you will be beaten by a system. At the same time, having a unique password for every service you sign up for, even if it's an algorithm that you're doing in your mind, even though a system will be able to break that, you're doing better than using the same one everywhere, right? So it's always gradients. And I've got to say that the solution I've come up with that I think, I mean, for myself, and you probably do the same, is I just use a service. I just use a system that generates random passwords and a vault. I guess that's your number. Do you have one of those?
I mentioned that. I use LastPass. I think you mentioned you use 1Password.
That's right, yeah.
A lot of people will recommend KeePass. Password Pack is like a kind of an enterprise solution a lot of companies use.
If you're not into really trusting your phone and having one device that has it, I mean, I also, my 1Password vault, if you will, I hold on my device, and then that vault gets saved encrypted in Dropbox and sync between all my devices. So as I make changes to it, it's always available, which is nice and convenient. But of course, that vault, which has all my passwords, is in one service company, right? And even though I encrypt it, it's, who knows? You know, there's always a potential with having a vault of that source. And you use the same type of thing with LastPass. The other way to do this, there's some services online where you can just print out a grid and walk through a paper password. So the other way to do it is just take, have a piece of paper in your wallet and just write down your passwords in there. And that's not great in the sense that somebody can snag it, but it's a lot better than having it on your computer unencrypted.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to compromise somebody digitally than it is to physically compromise them. I mean, breaking into a house or following you on the subway and trying to steal your wallet, these are generally things that typical like non-Hollywood hackers would not dare attempt.
Right. Yeah, in that situation, it really depends on the government you're involved in, right? If you're trying to keep secrets from the government you're in, you mentioned earlier, like maybe being prosecuted because of your beliefs in some government environments. In that situation, having it in paper is probably a bad idea. Having a secret in your mind is probably better. So that's the benefit of having one of these encrypted vault things, is that the one long random password that I had to memorize that encrypts it, I never share with people. I don't have written down. It's just my hope that my mind will remember it is the only way to keep that vault safe. So that has a benefit. But, you know, I tried to move, I think, my grandmother onto a one password situation. And the concern I really had was, I am fully aware of where that vault is and what that password is and how I make sure it's always copied around, because I know how important it is. But it's a virtual thing and I'm putting importance on it. And that's a hard thing for everybody to do. You know, it's not a normal person that can say, this collection of ones and zeros is a crucial piece of importance to me. Don't lose this. You know, it's an odd way to think about the world.
It is. Most people are accustomed to thinking in terms of atoms, and they'll buy physical safes and all those things. And really, if you're trusting in the safe and the safe manufacturer, and you know, in many ways, like if you have an alarm system, you're trusting in systems.
Yeah.
It all comes down to trusting in systems that have been designed by somebody. There is a small risk of the system being compromised, that you can't avoid that in any situation. So at some point, you just have to take it on an act of faith. If I hypothetically got hit in the head really hard and like forgot critical passwords, then, you know, that would be very bad, because right. Only a few people have access to like a few key, you know, servers and services that are necessary to run FreeCodeCamp. Right. So, you know, there's always danger there, but you have to think in terms of what constitutes like a reasonable risk, and accept that if you're trying to expunge yourself of any risk whatsoever, then that's a fool's errand.
Right.
It's all about triaging.
All right, let's go ahead and handle one more. I'll let you pick the last one. First off, I just want to recommend everybody read this article. We'll have it posted from today's show notes, so you can read up on all the details of this article, even links to how to find out more about it and all that. But we want to pick the last one we're going to cover today.
Sure. Well, I'll talk about Signal.
Yeah. Okay. Which good.
I like a lot, and I think a lot of people like it a lot. I have a lot of friends who are into information security. And of course, like with any service, it's detractors and say it's not secure enough. And there's always that trade-off between, you know, convenience and security. Signal is basically an instant messaging app that is on iOS and Android and will run in a browser. So it's basically, it has a desktop version. And it allows you to do encrypted messaging back and forth with your friends and family. Mm-hmm. So I downloaded Signal. I immediately started sending like, hey, let's switch to Signal. And Signal just basically replaces your instant message client.
And has it been effective finding the people you want to talk to? Have most people moved over to Signal?
Yeah, well, so virtually everybody that I text with is like a close family member or friend or colleague. So like a lot of them are just like, okay, well, cool. I'll try this out. And I can easily, you know, say the merits. Like basically it makes it, Signal makes it virtually impossible, virtually, for someone to be able to snoop in on a conversation.
Right.
So the way it works is it's totally open source. It's totally free. Also, everything I mentioned in the article is completely free. Most of it is open source. And Signal basically will encrypt on my end. It will use cryptographic keys on my end when I send a message. And then the person whom I've added, like, also has like a key necessary to unencrypt that message so they can read it. But it's encrypted the entire transfer from my client to their client. It passes through the servers, encrypted and everything. So, mm-hmm. And you can even make encrypted phone calls with it too, which is pretty cool. So you don't have to worry about government organizations potentially dropping in on that, or it significantly reduces the risk. Again, right. I always want to emphasize, like, you're only so secure.
And the other thing is, like, it's the initial handshake is the trick, right? If I want to send a message to you and I have your phone number and I take my single account and put in your phone number and then it sends a note to you, during that initial pass, someone theoretically could insert and then be a man in the middle, which is a very tricky thing, and the system's designed not to do that. But those are the kind of risks that potentially could occur. But in any case, the Electronic Frontier Foundation gave it like a perfect score from a security perspective. It also is the same protocol, I believe, as Facebook Messenger. Is that right? Do you remember?
I think it's the same as WhatsApp.
Oh, WhatsApp.
So okay. I don't know about Facebook Messenger. WhatsApp,
no, but WhatsApp. But,
was acquired by – so WhatsApp is now encrypted. Now, there's probably still some metadata that Facebook could use there. I don't believe Facebook is just going to give people a free lunch. Right. I'm pretty sure they want people's data.
It's tricky, of course, because in this situation, you know, switching to Messenger makes sense. I mean, switching to Signal makes sense in the privacy perspective. At the same time, you know, explain to my aunt what it is and how to move from it when she already can text me via my text messages or Hangouts, Google Hangouts, or through Facebook, it will take a bit of pressure to do this, a choice, an intentional choice to move this direction.
Right. And I just want to point out the Signal client, the Signal app that you download on your phone, it deals with normal unencrypted text messages as well. So you can use it for all your text messaging. If people accept your, like, actually download Signal, then all of your texts between you and them won't be encrypted. But let's say your aunt, unless you're talking about something like really personal, or maybe you're okay with your conversation with your aunt. Maybe you're just talking about, you know,
the holidays or something,
birthday parties or something. I don't know. Then maybe it's not that big of a deal, and your aunt doesn't need to. It doesn't inconvenience either of you for you to be using Signal.
Right.
She still gets text messages like normal. You still get hers like normal. And if she decides to go ahead and download Signal, then she'll be encrypted as well.
So you also go through the idea of incognito mode. It maybe isn't secure enough. Using Tor for private browsing the net, and some other suggestions. And I just got to say that it's a great article. I highly recommend the read for anybody that would want to take a peek and learn more about this, how you do more private searching, not having Google collect all the data as you search the web. There's a lot of wonderful resources. It's if you want to go directly to the site, it's medium.freecodecamp.com. And there's articles every day. I'm surprised how much you write. I'm thoroughly impressed with, and also not you, Quincy, a whole bunch of people you've gathered together to write interesting articles under the same umbrella site.
Yeah, so I can just say a couple quick things about that. We are the largest technology-focused publication, the largest technical publication that actually has articles by developers and designers and data scientists on Medium. And we have more than 200 writers, and many of them are very experienced developers, very experienced designers. Many of the articles are very rich in terms of covering a lot of deep topics. Like, we try to keep things as deep and rigorous as possible. And at the same time, we try to make every article as layperson accessible as possible. I actually personally go through and edit all these articles and make sure that they are as clear and not any more complicated than they need to be. So if you're looking for a place to read about technology where you won't feel out of your depth, that is very much the intention of our publication.
As we've been speaking, 16 more people have read this article. There's currently 3,480 people who've read it. So it's neat to see that kind of count go up.
Yeah, that's actually people who have been signed in to Medium and have clicked the recommend button. Actually, we've had almost 300,000 people read the article.
Sorry, I meant to like to recommend it, heart it, if you will. Yeah. So congratulations to the success of the blog, and I've really been enjoying it. And thank you so much for talking about how you can be more secure and why you might want to in less than an hour. So thank you, Quincy, for joining me on GeekSpeak again.
Thank you again for having me, Lyle.
All right. Take care. Hey, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark. Dave Lawrence is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you'd like. Just give us some credit. Thanks very much to Michael Newman, the Pet Star Music, for our theme song, and thank you for listening to episode 48 of season 16. See you next week.